Today on Against the Grain, we mark the publication of two books in 2023, one about the grouping of radical thinkers called the Frankfurt School, the other about winners and losers in U.S. democracy. I'm C.S. You'll hear from Thomas Wheatland and Juliet Hooker coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Last month, we presented a conversation with Juliet Hooker about her new book, Black Grief, White Grievance, The Politics of Loss. We focused on a portion of the book about Ida B. Wells and Harriet Jacobs, but there was another very prominent set of arguments that was not addressed. Later this hour, you'll hear a conversation with Juliet Hooker about what it's fair to expect from African Americans, who she characterizes as perpetual losers in U.S. democracy. We begin the hour with a conversation about the Frankfurt School, the enormously influential group of radical scholars who wrote about, among other things, authoritarianism, conformism, mass culture, and modernism. Thomas Wheatland wrote a book called The Frankfurt School in Exile. It was published in 2009. To mark the re-release of Tom's book this year by the University of Minnesota Press, we revisit portions of the interview I conducted in 2010 with the Assumption University-based historian. I began by asking Thomas Wheatland for a nutshell description of the Frankfurt School, known formally as the Institute for Social Research.
You'd have to compare it in modern-day terms to something along the lines of a think tank. It was an academic institute that was affiliated with the University of Frankfurt with a private subsidy from the Weil family. And it was populated by an entirely interdisciplinary research team. The cast of characters changed over time, which meant that the specialties being emphasized by the researchers changed over time. But during the time frame that I write about the Institute and during the time in which it achieved its notoriety and that it's probably best remembered for, it really truly was a multidisciplinary affair. So the purpose was to develop a comprehensive theory of contemporary society. And to accomplish that, the idea was to combine social science, Wissenschaft, with philosophy. So you'd have sociology being informed by philosophy, which today we'd refer to that mix as social theory. But at the time, the idea was that the theory production would then drive new directions in the sociology, and the sociology at the same time would constantly fuel and help to alter the theory production. So in terms of staff, the director of the institute was a philosopher, Max Horkheimer. There were also several economists on the staff, but Horkheimer's second in command was an economist by the name of Friedrich Pollack, who really functioned as a kind of administrator of the institute. There was another full-time philosopher on the staff who didn't get brought in until the mid-30s. That was Herbert Marcuse. There was a psychologist, Eric Fromm, a musicologist who also dabbled in sociology as well as philosophy, a very versatile scholar, Theodor Wiesengrund Adorno. And then you had literary scholars like Walter Benjamin and Leo Löwenthal. They had a lot of different disciplines represented, but that was a reflection of the kind of sociological and theoretical task that they'd set for themselves.
How would you characterize the Frankfurt School's attitude or approach toward Marxian ideas?
One really important thing to understand about them is that they were all unaffiliated Marxists. Unlike unlike a lot of other comparable figures from Europe during this time period or from the United States during this time period, they weren't members of the Social Democratic Party, they weren't members of the Communist Party, they weren't syndicalists, they were unaffiliated, unallied. I mean, they certainly were heavily influenced by Marx, and they were profoundly influenced by the revolutions that had occurred in Germany in 1918 and 1919. But in terms of, you know, they were critical of the Soviet Union, that was something that was understood and assumed and came up a lot in conversations with one another, but that's not something that they would ever share with anybody else in the context of this country. I think the other thing that made them maybe unusual as Marxists during this time period is that they were very critical of Marx. I mean, there's a famous interview, I don't know how famous it is, but it's that Brian McGee did. He used to have a television show from the UK on philosophy, and he had Marcuse on as a guest. And he asked Marcuse this whole long series of questions about Marx. And, you know, in general, many of the judgments were quite critical and biting. And then McGee sort of finished up this line of questioning by saying, So why is it that you're a Marxist? You've just articulated some of the most devastating critiques of Marx that I've ever heard in my life. How can you still call yourself that? So mm-hmm. So that's, you know, compared to a lot of other people, especially in this country that they encountered in New York, who considered themselves Trotskyists, or maybe that wasn't even good enough. They were Shachmanites, you know, so it's highly factionalized, but also, you know, people taking very identifiable political and cultural positions. These were people that didn't want to get into that.
There's such a rich discussion in this book, and you and I, Tom, decided to focus on two sections of the book. One, the interactions that the Frankfurt School, or the lack thereof, that the school had with a group called the New York Intellectuals. They coalesced in New York City, and specifically Greenwich Village. Tell us about this group and who belonged to it.
They're a hard group to define. I focused on four magazines in particular that had stables of writers that they consistently asked to write pieces for them. So Partisan Review is probably the most famous of these journals. There's also Commentary that was later published by the American Jewish Committee, Politics, which was founded by Dwight MacDonald, and Dissent, which was founded and managed for many years by Irving Howe and by Louis Kozer. These were all leftists of one stripe or another. Many of them, I mean, Partisan Review started out as an organ of the Communist Party, but as time went on, the shackles that the Communist Party put on them, the lack of freedom that it gave them, created tremendous tension. And then I think also it was, these were, as the term that we use to describe them, their label suggests, they were intellectuals. And much of the Communist Party at that time was not interested in quite the kind of highbrow, overt intellectualism that these writers and journals tended to promote. They also, in addition to being leftists who increasingly became intensely anti-Stalinist, I mean, they came to embody a kind of anti-Stalinist left, but way before McCarthyism ever took shape, but it was still left. They also were some of the most passionate supporters of modernism in the arts. So Clement Greenberg came out of this milieu as a champion of abstract expressionism. And you also had some of the first and most articulate proponents of European avant-garde literature.
And when you say modernist, there was a whole, of course, modernist movement and modernist project. Is it easiest for listeners just to think of it in terms of avant-garde art and aesthetics?
Yeah, I would say to some degree, they felt, and this is where I think many of them became interested in similar themes as what the Frankfurt School was grappling with, they had a sense that there was a natural relationship between modernism's ability to express and explore in very innovative ways consciousness, human consciousness, And they felt that these very advanced forms of art also had, I mean, this was also modernism as they understood it was highly cosmopolitan, it was internationalist, and that's also the way that they saw Marxism. So there is a way in which they believed that there was a natural affinity between their politics and their cultural preferences, but how one sorted that out, that became a very problematic and complicated task for them to articulate. And that is ultimately, I think, where the Frankfurt School wound up becoming quite influential for many of them.
So you have members of the Frankfurt School arriving in New York City in the mid-1930s. Which people and what kinds of people served as initial bridges between the Frankfurt School, the Horkheimer Circle, and New York's intellectual communities?
It was largely editors and translators. One of the biggest obstacles that members of the Frankfurt School had was the ability to communicate this very complex writing style that they had adopted, to communicate that to English audiences. They had translators who really functioned as full-blown editors who were assisting them with this. And they really are a pretty extraordinary group of people. Moses Finkelstein, who most people don't know by that name, most people know him by the name that he adopted later in life. That's M.I. Finley. He was a famous classicist at Oxbridge in England. He was one of the first and earliest translators and editors for these people. He was a classical historian, kind of pioneered the social history of the classical world and social history of ideas in the classical world. And he was also an instructor at City College in New York City. So as a teacher at City College, he had people in his class like Daniel Bell, like Irving Howe, like Nathan Glaser. And that's one of the ways that word of the Frankfurt School started to circulate among the world of the New York intellectuals. In addition to M.I. Finley, there was also Benjamin Nelson, who went on to become another noted social historian and social scientist. He was a translator and an editor for the Institute, and similarly also taught at City College. So it was largely through people like this that people connected with these little magazines started to become aware of them. And because of the eventually, as all these people graduated from college and began trying to eke out these bohemian lives as freelance writers, many of this younger generation of New York intellectuals wound up actually doing editorial work and translation work for the Institute during the 1940s. So Daniel Bell was also a translator and editor for the Institute on some significant projects as well. Nathan Glaser was also a research assistant of Max Horkheimer during the mid-1940s. And Irving Howe was a ghost editor of Prophets of Deceit, which was a book written by Leo Lowenthal.
Thomas Wheatlin joins us on Against the Grain. He teaches German history at Assumption College, and he is author of the book The Frankfurt School in Exile. And by in exile, he means the years, or many of the years, that the Frankfurt School scholars spent in the U.S. and in New York City specifically. One way we can talk about the impact of Frankfurt School ideas on the New York intellectuals is to discuss what the Frankfurt School came to think about mass culture and authoritarianism, and the links between mass culture and art and authoritarianism, totalitarianism, fascism. What links did they begin to make? And then later on, I guess we can talk about how those ideas were received in New York.
Mm-hmm. Well, initially they had been doing social scientific work on the study of authority. They'd been studying it in relation to family. So authoritarianism was something that they'd been studying for a long time. And this is one of the reasons why among emigre groups, they weren't exactly surprised by the coming of Nazism to Germany, which is part of the reason they got out as early as they did. So they'd been interested in authoritarianism for quite a long time. They'd also been interested in aesthetics for a long time. Their approach to art, whether it be literature or music, was to take a sociological approach to it. So to look at a particular piece of art. So take, for example, Adorno writing about Schönberg, the atonal musical composer from Vienna. There's a way in which Adorno would look at Schönberg in relation to society at that moment in time and would also then theorize about the reception that Schönberg was having. And he would speculate and theorize about Schönberg's overall significance to music. That starts to change as the Institute does more and more work on authority. I think that as they come to see that the working class, for example, which, you know, as many Marxists, they'd had some hope in the working class progressively changing society, as they conducted these studies on both the German working class and then authoritarianism within families, they came to realize that these hopes were unjustified and that there was a kind of political conformity, a kind of deference to authority itself that seemed to be endemic within the working class and within other strata of German and American society. And that then also began to affect many of the ways that they started thinking about art. So just as they saw increasing amounts of conformity in the political and social and cultural behavior of ordinary people, they also began to focus and uncover more and more cultural conformity in the realm of aesthetic production. So really the rise of mass culture, of mass art, became a preoccupation and a fascination of theirs. Now, unlike a lot of other people who wrote about mass art, and particularly a lot of Americans who wrote about mass art, a lot of people like to look at it as a kind of big business conspiracy. This was something that Hollywood, for example, was foisting on these innocent audiences, and there was this insidious brainwashing that was going on. But the Frankfurt School's analysis of mass culture was quite a bit more nuanced than that. They wanted to really dissect what a mass culture product was, so functionally what it looked like, and then what relationship did it have to the audience? And then to look at the larger social trends as to why there was more of this being produced and less, you know, what people might have referred to as autonomous art or authentic art. And that ultimately is something quite different from what a lot of other critics of mass culture were doing either in this country or in other parts of Europe during the time.
You write that one way in which the New York intellectuals, or at least some of them, disagreed with or differed from the Frankfurt School notions on mass culture and authoritarianism, one way they differed was the fact that some New York intellectuals saw the masses as passive objects of manipulation by mass culture, by cinema and art.
That's correct. And I think that one of the things that the Frankfurt School was saying is that they're not entirely passive. There's a reason why this kind of art is popular. It's not some kind of crazy mind control. The model that a lot of the New York intellectuals were using was Hollywood and its mass cultural products they have a resemblance to Stalinist art, to Soviet realism in the Soviet Union, or to Nazi propaganda art. And I think that the Frankfurt School ultimately said, no, that's not exactly correct, because really the appeal of this art is not what you might otherwise expect. This is an art, mass art is an art of eternal sameness. And so it renders a kind of pre-processed or pre-digested art product, and it thereby robs the consumer of the intuitive encounter with the sublime, because we can't invest ourselves in mass art because it's already socially mediated through its constant sameness, because it has this relationship, it's kind of replicant of so much else that's already out there. So there's a way in which what they're essentially proposing is the shift of art to fashion, which I think a lot of people today would not be very surprised by a proposition like that, but back in the context of the 1930s and the 1940s, that was a pretty radical thing to say.
Tom, earlier on, you were telling me about a kind of project that the New York intellectuals were engaged in, which was the attempt, an attempt to build bridges between modernism and radical political thought and theory. Can you tell us more about what kind of synthesis the New York intellectuals were attempting and to what degree you thought they were successful?
Well, I think that the synthesis was an attempt to explore the realm of consciousness, which was increasingly becoming a main focal point of interest for Western Marxists in Europe, but I think also a lot of these anti-Stalinist Marxists in New York, the expectations regarding the working class and what was taking place with the working class, it was starting to become clear that those expectations didn't appear to be accurate. And so an aesthetic sensibility that had the potential, or a philosophical sensibility or a sociological sensibility that had the ability to explore that realm of consciousness and to really... This is part of the reason why Freud becomes so popular for so many of these people during this period of time. Freud becomes another theoretical tool for trying to explain the kinds of non-rational drives that exist at the core of people personally. So I think that that's one of the things that attracted the New York intellectuals to modernism as well. They become interested in Freud quite a bit later than the Frankfurt School does. And I think that the Frankfurt School is actually one of the reasons that they become as interested in Freud as they do. But it's this realization, I think, on the part of lots of leftists all over the world that the kind of highly rationalistic explanation of human drives and nature that lay at the work of Marx and Engels and the Second International, that those assumptions had to be seriously interrogated and reinvestigated. And so modernism seemed to be a fruitful place to conduct those types of investigations. Now, what's awkward, I mean, there also were many of the New York intellectuals who just, it was their preference. They liked modernism. And one of the things that was very awkward for them is how do you reconcile a love of a reactionary writer like Ezra Pound or T.S. Eliot with these political sensibilities that you have? Nevertheless, they tried. And despite the fact that the political intentions and aims of the author might be totally distasteful to you, the nature of the work itself may help to uncover useful realizations about contemporary social reality that might be of use in a political context. And so I think that a lot of the work that the New York intellectuals were engaged in was attempting to do that. What they also wanted to do was to try and theorize about how aesthetic modernism fit together with aesthetic radicalism, and they really had a lot of problems with that. I mean, the closest that they came to a really highly developed theory of that was this essay that Clement Greenberg published called Avant-Garde and Kitsch. But, you know, I mean, really, it wasn't until the Frankfurt School came along and made the proposition that it's not just art's ability to expose these deeper psychological levels of consciousness that makes modernism interesting and significant on a social theoretical level. I mean, the other thing that they claimed, I mean, you had two schools of thought within the Frankfurt School. I mean, on the one hand, you had someone like Marcuse, who really believed that art was a way of seeking utopia. And so it is within art that one imagines the beautiful and the good, and that therefore it serves this really vital purpose. In the case of Adorno, I think, you know, a lot of his aesthetic theory tended to be much more critical and negative because his assessment of the world in many respects was a lot bleaker than Marcuse's, and that was in this world of total administration, complete conformity, and total domination. Not only do you have a regression, an artistic regression in the imagination of the audience, you also have a regression in the minds of critics as well as in the minds of artistic producers, so that you actually see autonomous art very rapidly vanishing. Not only the market space for it vanishing, but literally it vanishing. And so the art that Adorno came to appreciate is the art that was defiant in its relationship to the status quo. So it was art that refused to be appropriated. And, you know, I mean, think of the music of Schoenberg. I mean, the Boston Symphony Orchestra was doing these Beethoven programs a couple of years ago. But the reason that they were doing Beethoven so much, they did all of Beethoven's symphonies, but they would always pair it with something by Schoenberg or one of Schoenberg's students. And James Levine said in the press, the reason that we're doing this is because people hate Schoenberg, but they should hear him and they should know him.
Thomas Wheatland, Associate Professor of History at Assumption University, talking with me shortly after the initial publication of his book, The Frankfurt School in Exile, in 2009. The book was re-released this year. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain. We devote the rest of this hour to Juliet Hooker's new book, Black Grief, White Grievance, The Politics of Loss. As I mentioned at the top of the hour, the conversation with Juliet that we presented last month addressed only some of the insights shared and contentions made in her book. An important set of arguments advanced in her book were drawn from a conference paper that Juliet, now a political science professor at Brown University, presented back in 2016. As a way of introducing you to more of what's in Juliet's new book, we present the following portions of a conversation I had with her about her paper.
Suffering and loss, I mean, this describes what's happening to African Americans and the Black community in the face of police brutality. I'd like to ask you about what the political theorist Danielle Allen has written about the role of loss in democratic politics.
So one of the very insightful ideas that Allen explores is this notion that democracies are, or the experience of democracy, of being a citizen in a democracy, is defined by loss. And this is because citizens have different policy preferences. And inevitably, in a democracy where the majority, right, wins in any kind of policy debates, that means that there are winners and losers. That means that there's some people whose preferences get enacted and others who don't. And so while we think that democracy is about right participation and getting your agenda enacted, it's also about having the opposite happen, right? About not seeing that happen. So that she argues that, right, this experience of loss, of having to cope with losing an argument, is something that all citizens experience, and that therefore democracies have to find ways to cope with the experience of loss.
Cope with the experience of loss. And what happens in Allen's mind when some parts of a society lose more? They lose systematically. There is a disproportionate balance between winners and losers.
So one of the things that she points to the 1960s, and she argues that up until that point in the United States, what you had was that losses weren't equally distributed, right? That one group, you know, essentially got the task of winning and another got the task of being good losers. And the good losers were African Americans who weren't allowed to participate in politics, who were barred from equal employment opportunities, et cetera, who were operating under Jim Crow racial segregation. So one of the things that is key then to this idea of loss is that in a democracy, it's supposed to be arbitrarily distributed, right? There shouldn't be one systematic group that is always the one that loses a debate, that loses in terms of a policy decision, because the experience then of having to sacrifice, right, to have to peacefully accept that you lost, is one that all groups need to experience in order for it to be legitimate. Otherwise, what you have is like an uneven democracy where certain groups are always expected to be the ones who peacefully accept their losses and who sacrifice by peacefully accepting rather than revolting. And I think one of the, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the paper is that I don't think that this stopped happening in the 1960s. I think we continue to have a pattern by which Blacks or African Americans or Democratic losers are the ones who are expected to cope with and to make sacrifices on behalf of U.S. democracy.
The novelist and literary critic Ralph Ellison, he had some strong opinions about whether African Americans should peacefully accept their losses. What did he write? What did he think?
Ellison is very interesting on this point. He comes to talk about this issue of democratic sacrifice in the context of a critique of the philosopher Hannah Arendt's, her critique actually of the Black parents and of the NAACP, whom she saw as pushing for school desegregation and putting school children, you know, African-American young children in harm's way or exposing them to social rejection. And so she penned this very famous, infamous essay, Reflections on Little Rock, and Ellison, responding to her, argues that she missed the way in which actually these battles for school desegregation, in which African Americans essentially put their bodies on the line and expose themselves to, you know, to white rage for the sake of greater equality, were these moments of heroic sacrifice. And he argues that, you know, African Americans in the South had to learn to give up the desire for retaliation or revenge, not just because, you know, they could be killed or because they were subject to sort of arbitrary racial violence, but also, he argues, because they had a duty to themselves and to the community to heroically accept those losses and sacrifice the need for revenge.
So he thought that if Blacks responded to racial terror with violence of their own, then their lives, the African-American lives, would be endangered, would be further endangered. What did he think about what peaceful acquiescence on the part of Blacks would do to whites' inclination to support the cause of racial justice?
I think he thought that it would impel people, particularly white citizens, who would, you know, be able to see this heroic sacrifice, to then sympathize with the struggle of African Americans for racial equality, and that it would therefore lead to a kind of transformation in their support for racial justice.
Right, and here we are talking about nonviolent protest. I mean, it's not that Ellison just said African Americans shouldn't do anything. He did support nonviolent activism as a way of trying to transform society.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what he was trying to suggest against critiques like Arendt's is precisely that, you know, I think we have one of the things that I think has happened is that we have developed a kind of selective memory about the civil rights movement in the 1960s and about how people responded to it. And so I think that one of the things that the debate between Ellison and Arendt, one of the things that it shows is that not everyone responded to the civil rights movement by thinking, oh, these are, you know, heroic, peaceful, respectable protests that we should endorse. Many people saw them as creating confrontations that were unnecessary or were leading to these potentially violent encounters between citizens and the police, and that there were other ways to carry out the struggle. So even though it was, right, a movement based around nonviolence, there were critiqued on various fronts. And I think one of the things that Ellison was trying to say in response to critics like Arendt is that putting your body on the line and exposing yourself to violence because you're trying to defend your rights is a form of heroism. It is a form of, you know, a sacrifice that you are making on behalf of the political community and that it needed to be honored.
Well, what you just alluded to represents part of a critique that you have of a couple myths around the civil rights movement, myths that some people who have criticized the way Black Lives Matter and other protesters have conducted themselves rely on. So one is certainly this notion that, you know, if oppressed people act in an exemplary nonviolent way, members of the dominant racial group, in this case, whites, will be ethically transformed. They'll be spurred to denounce and renounce racial oppression. And you are suggesting, you're indicating that you have a lot of doubt about this, even based on the historical record. Are we returning here to your notion of solidarity and your sense that people of a certain race have a difficult time adopting a kind of empathy and concern for another racial group such that they might be, that their hearts might be moved or changed by, for example, seeing African Americans being beaten in the South in the 60s?
Yeah, I think that this is precisely one of the core arguments that I want to make, which is that I think one of the critiques of the Black Lives Matter movement and the sort of protests against, contemporary protests against police violence has been that they have not behaved right in the kind of exemplary way that the civil rights movement protesters did, and that this is the reason that they haven't garnered the same degree of empathy or of support from the public at large. And one of the things that I think it's important to consider is, A, that we're relying on a false narrative about the civil rights movement, right? So going back to the point I was making earlier, in retrospect, we tend to assume that the civil rights movement was met with immediate support and affirmation. But in fact, right, the civil rights movement, I mean, Martin Luther King was seen as an agitator, right? He was, you know, the people who say that the Black Lives Matter, that some of the organizers, they're professional protesters. He would have been called a professional protester in his time. He was, you know, going from city to city that was experiencing racial strife and organizing people to protest. So I think that we have this notion that nonviolence meant non-confrontation, and I don't think that that's true. I think that what the strategy of the civil rights movement was to bring about a confrontation that would make visible the facts of white supremacy and how it was organized and how it was carried out violently in the South. And so I think that that's one issue, right, is this sort of false narrative that we have in retrospect, the sort of romanticized notion of the civil rights movement. And I think the other important thing to think about is whether what we think happens in those moments, right? When we think that people are confronted with the reality of racial violence, the assumption coming from this narrative about the civil rights movement is that, right, Northern white audiences watching these confrontations unfold, watching these peaceful civil rights protesters in the 60s who were, in some cases, attacked, right, by white police forces, that this led people to renounce racism and to support racial justice. So one of the questions that I raise in the paper is that even if we grant that is what happened, and I have I talk about how that may not have been the case for everyone, and the example that I give there is this example of, again, going back to the essay by Arendt on Reflections on Little Rock, where she is looking at these photographs, right, these iconic photographs of the civil rights movement that appear in newspapers like the New York Times, which show these African-American school children who are being sort of harassed by these enraged white mobs trying to prevent them from entering schools. And what she sees is these children who are being asked to be heroes by their parents who are not there and who don't accompany them. And by the NAACP, that's not there. And so she turns it not into a moment where she is, it prompts her to solidarity, but rather into the basis of a critique of why are these children being put on the front lines of these struggles for race or justice. So what I suggest then is that is partly that these moments of racial confrontation are complicated and that we can't make assumptions about how they're being received and interpreted by those watching. And I think we see that, for example, today as well with the videos that have emerged of these incidents of police violence, right? A lot of people say, looking at, for example, the, you know, the videos of for example, Eric Garner getting choked or other of these videos, that how can you see that and not see that the police acted wrongly? But there are people who look at those videos and say, well, why was he resisting? Why didn't he immediately do this? So I think that this assumption that there is a kind of predetermined moral operation that's going to happen as a result is wrong, basically.
That's Juliet Hooker talking with me about a conference paper that Juliet's new book, Black Grief, White Grievance, draws heavily from. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Juliet Hooker is a political scientist based at Brown University. Here's more of that interview, conducted in 2016.
You also write that this romantic narrative of the civil rights movement shifts attention away from Black loss and toward the idea that Black politics should be oriented toward the goal of democratic repair rather than racial justice.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to get at there is the fact that this narrative, right, about these sort of middle class, respectable, well-behaved, nonviolent, heroic Black protesters who put themselves and their bodies on the line in order to achieve greater racial justice, then one of the things that it does is suggest that there is one legitimate form that Black politics should take, right? And it's that form. And it's this form in which Blacks peacefully acquiesce to their losses. And when they protest, right, when they try to bring about change in racist structures, that they need to do so in a nonviolent way that is acceptable, that adheres to the norms of civility, that doesn't sort of offend white sensibilities, that they're not allowed to express, for example, rage, which is in some ways a very normal response to violence and to terror and to injustice, right? There's something absolutely normal and healthy about being angry at injustice. But that sort of range of human emotion is precluded by this mythical idea that what Black citizens should do is be these kind of superhuman figures who acquiesce peacefully, who put their bodies on the line, who enact this form of political heroism, and who in so doing are sacrificing themselves on behalf of the common good, right? Because what they're achieving is this greater good of more racially egalitarian society. But I think one of the things that I think is important to think about is whether, in fact, that shifts attention away from the kind of disparities and injustices that prompt Black protests in the first place, and on to this question of, well, how do we preserve peaceful, stable democracy rather than how do we address the injustices that cause people to protest in the first place?
Well, if, as you seem to be suggesting, African Americans are expected to be, in a sense, good losers by practicing the politics of respectability and nonviolence and to some degree acquiescence, although
you know, as you've said, nonviolent protest does not equal acquiescence, then it is instructive to look at whether whites in U.S. society have been good losers, have been the kind of losers that they expect, in your opinion, blacks to be. And you go back to the 1960s when, you know, at least some of the privileges, the racial privileges of whites were undermined or eliminated. You go back and look at whether whites could or should be considered good losers at that time. What do you conclude?
So I conclude that they were not good losers. They have not been good losers. And the basis for this actually is a very discernible pattern in U.S. politics, where moments of, you know, victories for greater racial equality have been followed by these periods of backlash and retrenchment, where rights that have been gained have slowly been eroded. We see this with the Civil War, right, which leads to the end of slavery and is followed by Reconstruction and the attempt to enfranchise African American men, which is then followed by the post-Reconstruction period of disenfranchisement, the, you know, establishing of racial segregation and Jim Crow, and of, you know, sort of white supremacy as a, you know, official ideology of the country. And if you look at the 1960s, I think what we see is a similar pattern, right? The victories of the civil rights movement, which were, you know, of course, quite important and made enormous changes to U.S. society, were followed by, I think, a period where some of those gains have slowly been eroded. If you look at today, the dismantling of things like the Voting Rights Act or the placing barriers to minority voter registration, things of that sort, I think we see that some of the policies that were put in place in the 60s are being dismantled and were followed by this period, I think, of racial resentment. I think we see this even with the election of Obama in 2008, which I think a lot of people thought would lead to this moment of greater, right, sort of post-racial moment in the United States, where people had finally elected a non-white president and it would lead to greater racial harmony. And I think instead what we've seen is a period of backlash. And I think this is clearly a response to this issue of democratic loss, right? That I think many, unfortunately, I think many whites saw this as loss and see, right, the election of an African-American or the, you know, the greater political participation of Latinos, they see this as threats that threaten their interests. And I think that leads to the sense of sort of white victimhood, where, you know, you have these sort of narratives about how the country is being taken over, or these fears about minorities that show that, you know, the kind of acceptance of loss, right? The acceptance of, you know, no, not every president will always be white, which has been the norm, is not something that is which white citizens have had to cope. They never had to cope with it, right, before Obama.
So, Juliet, if you're not in agreement with the thinker Danielle Allen about, you know, she's saying that people who are losers in democracy have to cope with the experience of loss in an exemplary fashion. If you're not in agreement with Ralph Ellison, who speaks of a, you know, a special duty to act within the rule of law and act heroically and, you know, sacrifice the need for revenge, if you feel like nonviolent protests during the 1960s did not, in fact, shame a lot of whites into coming around to the project of racial justice, or at least agreeing with it, then what kind of politics are you suggesting? What kinds of politics are you advocating for those people who are justifiably outraged by police brutality and police violence?
So I think what I'm trying to suggest is that to expect Black citizens who are the ones who are experiencing this defining moment of racial terror to further sacrifice by being the ones responsible for the work of repairing the wrongs of racial justice is to add another sacrifice to those who are already sacrificing, right? To add another loss to those who are already experiencing losses. So what I'm suggesting is that the burden of, you know, dismantling white supremacy shouldn't rest solely or primarily with those who are experiencing, for example, police violence. I also want to suggest that I think that Black politics should be oriented towards making visible the harms that are being suffered, that African Americans are suffering. And so that instead of it necessarily being oriented only at, right, sort of repairing, you know, following these norms of civility so that it can garner white sympathy, that it should be concerned with expressing anger at injustice, with trying to make visible those wrongs. And I think that this is a different orientation, because I think that it means that instead of being concerned with how do you present your demands in such a way that you might elicit white sympathy, it's about protesting injustice. And if white sympathy follows, then that's great. But that Black politics shouldn't be oriented towards this idea of democratic sacrifice, because I think it moves the focus away from the problems of racial injustice onto how do we engage in sort of these civil debates about, you know, repairing U.S. democracy, rather than focusing on how to overcome racial injustice.
Juliette Hooker, talking about a set of arguments that feature prominently in her new book, Black Grief, White Grievance, The Politics of Loss. Juliette is professor of political science at Brown University. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.